Good evening, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia, and it's the 7th of December 2011. Welcome to another show. My name is Hereward Fenton, and I've been running this show for about 3.5 years. We've been covering numerous issues that are both local and international, scientific, political, geopolitical, looking at the forces that are shaping the world, trying to deconstruct the motives and the agendas of the criminal cartels and elites who are, even as we speak, raping, pillaging and undermining freedom and democracy all across the planet. I don't use those words lightly, and I really wish it were not the case. I wish it were not our sad and solemn duty to actually report on these matters, but unfortunately we have to do this, and believe me, I would much prefer not to focus on so much gloom, but then again I would rather talk about that than distract myself endlessly with mindless tabloid lurid fascinations of people, famous people, politicians, etc., or sports, or the mindless fascination with television shows which are increasingly just stirring some kind of mental soup of fear and violence and some sort of internal state of dysfunction that people seem to need, actually, as almost like an antidote to the dysfunction in their life. They plunge into this sort of fantasy world of television police shows and things that are all about twisted, violent killers and just or just... really shallow comedy that has no no message other than the underlying one that life is just a joke. But enough of that. Let me talk about what is coming up today in tonight's show. I have coming in the next segment an interview with Craig Isherwood, who is the President and Treasurer of the Citizens Electoral Council. And I'm going to explore with Craig a number of issues. I've been talking to Craig on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM quite regularly for the past few weeks. And we've been dabbling in a number of subjects. We've been looking at eugenics. We've been looking at the climate change fraud. And today we were actually talking on the radio about Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution, which Mr. Isherwood claims to be a giant fraud. Now, I won't say that I'm in total agreeance, you know, that I embrace 100% what Craig says. However, I think that the amount of research that he has done into these topics and the amount of detailed knowledge that he has about the history of these topics is in itself extremely valuable. He has a perspective. We want to get the perspective. And you, the listener, can have a think about it and hopefully get back to us with your thoughts and comments. I'll just read to you here from the Wikipedia article on Citizens Electoral Council, and this will give you a sense of how the mainstream views someone like Craig Isherwood and a party like the CEC. The Citizens Electoral Council is a minor nationalist political party affiliated with the International LaRouche Movement. It is reported as was having 549 members in 2007. They have been described as far-right, fascist, and lunar right, as well as ideologues of the economic left. That's directly from Wikipedia. I don't quite understand the ideologues of the economic left part of it. The original CEC was established by members of the Australian League of Rights, an extreme right-wing group led by Eric Butler, in the 1980s in Queensland. That again is taken directly from Wikipedia, and I'll be asking Craig about that specific claim. Its purpose was to lobby for binding voter-initiated referenda. CEC candidate Trevor Perrott won the 1988 Barambah state by-election in Queensland, held after former Queensland Premier Sir Joh Bjelke-Petersen resigned from state parliament in 1987. Now, I'll just leave you with that to think about. I want to, in the time we have left before the interview, I need to return to a very important topic. Now, the topic to which I wish to return is none other than that of Chappelle Corby and the whistleblower allegations that we have been talking about. And I really need to emphasize that this is a breaking situation which is changing constantly, and it's really important to basically do everything you can to try and get up to speed with it. We've actually had to remove some things, and a number of articles that were online have actually been removed. And one of them is actually not an article, but a YouTube interview, which was done by the Expendable Project. Now, the man who was interviewed goes by the name of Colin Chapman. He is a private investigator, and I've actually verified that Colin Chapman is a real person, and you can do the same by putting his name into Google, and you will find that he actually is well known in the media, and he was doing a lot of work for Channel 7, and he's also done a lot of work locating missing persons. Now, Colin Chapman did an interview with the Expendable Project on expendable.tv, in which he made a number of searing allegations about the behaviour of Channel 7. Subsequent to that interview, Kim Bax, who is the leader of a group called Women for Chappelle, posted an article on her WordPress blog, which repeated some of the information that was on the Expendable Project's page. And unfortunately, she went a little bit further than that and made a number of allegations of her own against a certain individual within Channel 7, and I will just leave it at that, which led to severe legal repercussions upon her. And as a result of that, her article has now come down, and the ExpendableProject.tv YouTube has now come down. However, it was online for several days, and certainly long enough for many, many thousands or millions of people to have looked at it, and certainly long enough for many people to have downloaded the audio. The claims that were made by Colin Chapman basically accuse Channel 7 of orchestrating and paying for illegal surveillance and things equivalent to what we heard in the UK with the phone hacking saga, but really worse. We're talking about the bugging of people's homes. We're talking about the tracking of people. We're talking about a sustained and really, really intense invasion of privacy of an entire family. And all apparently for the purpose of digging up dirt on the Corby family so that it could justify the claims that Channel 7 had made in earlier television programs where they had aired the allegations of Jodie Power, who was actually Chappelle Corby's best friend. And of course, after Jodie Power made the allegations claiming that the Corby family was involved in drugs, a defamation suit was launched against Channel 7 by Chappelle's sister, Mercedes. And during the course of that defamation suit, Channel 7 tried to find information to corroborate its story. And according to Colin Chapman in the interview that he did, after 4 years, they didn't get anywhere. There really was no information. The only information that came forward was from people such as Malcolm McCauley, discredited, Kim Moore, discredited, both people with criminal backgrounds, both people whose statements have to be regarded with extreme suspicion. And in the case of Kim Moore, Colin Chapman said that he actually did some investigation of his own and actually was able to bait her by asking her questions to see if she would respond in a way to sort of amplify any suggestions that he made. And he found that he could basically lead her in any direction he wanted by seeding her with an idea, which she would then add on to basically amplify it into a story. So unfortunately, this type of behavior was going on in Channel 7, and according to Colin Chapman. But again, unfortunately, this has now been removed, and we're in a position now where we have to hope that someone again comes forward, or that Colin Chapman again comes forward. His phone number is actually available on the internet through a web article that was actually in the Sunshine Coast Daily. And I do urge listeners who are interested in this topic to simply look that up. I mean, you can find this article called Search Continues for Missing Rhea. If you put that into Google, Search Continues for Missing Rhea, that's spelled R-E-Y-A, you will find an article which is all about Colin Chapman, and you will find at the end of that article a mobile phone number. And I can verify that the number actually works. So that summarizes the situation that we have there. But now let me just try and explain why this is so important. The situation with Chappelle in prison is a tragedy in itself. We know that. It's a tragedy for one person. And of course, it's a tragedy even if she was guilty, it's still a tragedy. And we have compassion. We don't want someone to be suffering. But of course, if I thought she was guilty, I wouldn't be making all this big deal about it, okay? Because there are many other people in prison, most of whom are guilty. Maybe some of them aren't, but the fact is that if you're guilty and you went over there with drugs and you did stuff, well, you know, you took the risk. You know, I think it's wrong that they lock people up for this. I don't think people should be locked up for drugs at all, to be honest with you. I think it's just a scheme and a scam to enable the illegal drug trade to continue. However, my concern here is not about that issue, which again is a very important issue. My concern is about the corruption of the media, the corruption of the government, the endemic dishonesty, the endemic covering up of the criminal activities by both government and media. And this is the part of it that we actually have to engage in. It is absolutely incumbent upon every citizen, every human being that has a conscience to take action when they see that the society that they live in and the institutions that are central to that society are being used to perpetrate dishonesty, which is leading to perversions of justice, to people being incarcerated, to potentially criminal activities ongoing under the cover of the disinformation that is spread by corrupt government, corrupt police, and corrupt media. So I urge you to look into it. Look into Colin Chapman. Look into the Expendable Project. After the break, we bring you Colin Chapman with an in-depth interview on the Citizens Electoral Council and the views of Craig Isherwood. Stay with us. Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back to Truth News. Well, today it's my great pleasure to have on the show Craig Isherwood, who is the leader of the Citizens Electoral Council. And I've been talking to Craig on Radio Skid Row on and off for the past few weeks, and we've actually been discussing a lot of topics that are really central to what's important to me and what we talk about on Truth News. One of the most important things being, I guess, the exposing the frauds that are going on in our society, exposing the dishonest manipulation of science, and trying to look at the deeper agenda about why this type of manipulation is going on. Now, Craig has done an enormous amount of research, and I found this with people from LaRouche generally. They seem to have a huge amount of knowledge of history and of the deeper agendas. So I'm going to be really interested in getting into some of that. I'd just like to say, Craig, welcome to Truth News.
Yeah, thanks, Harold. It'd be good to go through the issues that you've sort of indicated.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you know, basically exposing the fraud, and you know, we've been talking a lot about climate change, and that is one of the most stark and most obnoxious of the frauds that is going on at the moment. But it's by no means the only one. There are so many others. But I mean, you know, you've done a lot of work in basically deconstructing the climate change lies, and I do want to get into some of that. But I thought maybe why don't we just start with a brief rundown on who is the Citizens Electoral Council and how did it originally form?
Okay, well, the Citizens Electoral Council is what I would describe as a philosophical political party based upon the ideas of restoring national sovereignty to not just Australia but to all countries around the world. My wife and I started the party back in 1988 when there was a lot of turbulence following the stock market crash in October of that year. And then we basically formed it for the purposes of, putting an option to the people of actually returning to the ideas of national sovereignty, that the international banking system as such at that time, it was clear, was out of control. Mm. That the interests of Australia through the programs of, the policies of globalisation and privatisation were just beginning to start in a real earnest way at that point. And it was just really shocking. So we said we had to do something about this, so we started a political party. And about the same time, unbeknownst to us, there was an organisation in the US called the LaRouche Organisation, headed up by statesman and physical economist Lyndon LaRouche, who's now 89 years of age. And collaborators were working in New Zealand at the time, and also they had a presence in Australia via the telephone selling subscriptions to EIR magazine and Fusion magazine, which had something like 200,000 subscribers, which went through the latest discussion processes relating to cold fusion technologies, fusion generally, and other high-tech scientific solutions for mankind and for the development of economies around the world. So we became involved with Mr. LaRouche, and then in 1991 I actually travelled to the United States. I didn't meet Mr. LaRouche because he was actually in prison at the time, framed up under George Bush Sr.
Sure.
On all sorts of conspiracy charges. He posed a great deal of problems for the international financial elite, whom we call the oligarchy, because he nearly brought the system down in the 1980s through an operation with various South American countries called Operation Juarez, which was basically to be a debtors' cartel to hold the international financial system to ransom. But also in 1983, his proposal for the Strategic Defence Initiative, which was later called Star Wars, was accepted by the Reagan administration as an alternative to the MAD, mutually assured destruction of Henry Kissinger and so forth. And that basically brought the entire Cold War to an end at that point, because if there had been agreement between the Russians, Andropov at that point, and Reagan, the Russians actually pulled out of it, then there would have been a crash program for the development of high technologies, particularly beam weapons and plasma-based weapons in space, to make intercontinental ballistic missiles and consequently nuclear weapons obsolete. So you no longer had the threat of thermonuclear war. Now, that's what Mr. LaRouche actually was very, very close to bringing to fruition in 1983, and consequently that made him enemy number one for the financial elite, for the George Bush's administration, and consequently they had to get rid of him, and they just have been systematically trying to defame him ever since. But Mr. LaRouche is also regarded as a hero within Russia, because over there in Russia, when people stand up for principle and fight on scientific grounds and also for moral grounds, they tend to be regarded as heroes.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. So can you tell me a bit more about these plasma weapons? Or what was the actual technology that was to be deployed in space?
Well, these are beam weapons, you know, basically using high technology charged particle weapons in space, launched from satellites so that they can detect intercontinental ballistic missiles and destroy them in space, because those things have to go way up into the atmosphere to be able to make the distances. And that this is to use and to actually make the discoveries of new physical principles necessary to make those weapons work. And this was to be a collaborative program between Russia and the United States. And the Russians backed out under mainly the British influence at that time, specifically because they thought that they couldn't compete up with the with the Americans. And when Mr. LaRouche's proposal was rejected by the Russians, he then forecast that the Soviet Union would collapse in 1988. He forecast it would collapse. Well, so about 5 months later, it did actually collapse in 1989. He actually made that forecast. That
how does this differ from the Ronald Reagan Star Wars program? Because that was
it's the same program,
right?
But because there was so much opposition inside the United States, particularly from the George Bush faction, the conservative faction inside the United States.
Right.
That they sabotaged it everywhere they could. And actually, the initial proposal for the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was known as Star Wars, was originally written into the original speech of Reagan's, and his minders scrubbed it out. They took it out. But Reagan himself put it back in because Reagan hated the idea of thermonuclear war.
Mm.
So Reagan took that on his own initiative to announce. And, of course, that absolutely created a furor, that this sort of a policy direction could end the mutually assured destruction doctrine that has been the basis of the Cold War.
Wow. Look, we could do a whole show talking about that because,
yes,
I mean, because the current situation, of course, with the tensions growing between Russia and NATO are caused by the missile shield that NATO has built, which, of course, is seen as a threat. But you're actually saying that in this case, this would have been a global kind of shield that would stop potentially anyone from launching, which
that's correct.
It kind of makes sense.
It makes the whole use of intercontinental ballistic missiles, the ones that are a threat to sovereignty of individual nations, completely irrelevant, because they could be shot out of the sky by any country that deemed them a threat. But also it would then leave the pathway open for peaceful nuclear development on the face of the planet. So that's what they really were concerned about, is that if the threat of nuclear weapons was removed, that meant that we could actually develop nuclear power unfettered, because this big threat, you know, this big fear campaign of nuclear weapons would be taken away.
Yeah, really interesting.
Yeah.
I did a bit of Googling on the CEC, and I've come up here with a Wikipedia article, and it says that the CEC was established by members of the Australian League of Rights.
Yeah, that's one of the slanders that keeps coming back.
Right.
We were formed in 1988, Harrowood, the League of Rights was actually on the way down. Eric Butler was quite an old man at that point. He was the founder of the League of Rights. Now, when we started the CEC, we represented a singularity in Australian politics, because never before had there been a grassroots movement rise up and take a state seat like we did in Barambah in April of 1988.
Right.
That particular year.
Okay.
Now, this caused a total phenomenon. I mean, the Sunday program, which is now off air, of course, but it ran our interview with us, which by popular demand was played back in Western Australia twice, because we represented a singularity. Now, everyone and their dog wanted to jump on the bandwagon and try and woo us over to their way of thinking. And, you know, Eric Butler was part, and the League of Rights supporters were part, and, of course, this milieu in the rural Queensland bush. So they, you know, uninformed people that write these Wikipedia blogs, and you can't change them, by the way. They won't let us change this.
Right.
I'm the founder of the organisation. I'm saying it's rubbish. that they won't let me change it. So, I mean,
this
is Wikipedia for you. But the point is that, you know, there were legal rights supporters in the same milieu, the same mess.
Sure. Look, we're just going to break, Craig. I've learned to distrust Wikipedia. I usually have a look at it to get an idea, but I never accept what it says as factual. I just think it adds another piece of the jigsaw, and it often tells you what the mainstream thinks. Back after the break.
Yeah, okay.
I have a song lined up here called Free by Thievery Corporation. Back to Truth News Radio. Today I'm talking to Craig Isherwood, leader of the Citizens Electoral Council. and he's been explaining some of the history of the movement and what not to believe when you read Wikipedia, which I've learned the hard way on many topics. And Wikipedia is an example of a great idea that sort of, you know, just ended up being co-opted by power groups that use it to promote one particular point of view. And I have a feeling with Wikipedia, I don't know what you think, Craig, but it seems that the ownership of Wikipedia has its biases, and that is what determines what is allowed through in Wikipedia.
That's what I understand is the case, Howard.
Yeah.
They own, the intellectual copyright, and they can decide what they do with it. And that's how it works. When you put material up there, they can decide whether it stays or goes, and that's the problem you have with it.
Yeah, yeah. Look,
but I mean, in the case of the League of Rights, as we were talking to before the break, I mean, it wasn't true. I mean, we remained and still are a completely independent political party. Ever since the founding of our organisation back in 1988.
Right, sovereignty is a key issue. Where do you stand? I mean, if you were to sort of position yourself in the political spectrum, which I actually don't even agree with. I don't agree with the left-right spectrum at all. But I mean, how would you compare yourself to every other party? How does your party stand out?
We see ourselves as the continuation of the old Labor Party.
Okay.
Go back to the old Labor Party, go back to people like King O'Malley that established the Commonwealth Bank, and incidentally it's the 100th anniversary this year of the formation of the Commonwealth Bank. Have a look at him as a character. I mean, he fought, he called himself the Alexander Hamilton of Australia, the very famous Alexander Hamilton who established the first national bank in the United States.
Right.
You look at people like him, for example. You go back throughout the Labor Party's history, Jack Lang, who fought the money power of the City of London, Ben Chifley, John Curtin, these guys that stood up and actually saved our country from the Japanese onslaught when the British were going to give us away. You know, they drew a line called the Brisbane Line from Brisbane to Adelaide, and the policy up until Curtin took over was to basically give away Australia above that line. Now, Curtin forged an alliance with General Douglas MacArthur at that time in collaboration with Roosevelt, and consequently with MacArthur's incredible generalship and leadership, we were able to save our country. And at the same time, I might add, created an industrial revolution in our country that gave us the post-war, the very high post-war standard of living, because we actually developed manufacturing industries in this post-war, during the wartime mobilisation. So when we look at great figures in the past, Jack Lang, John, if you go back even earlier, back into the 1830s, 1840s, you see great Republican figures like John Dunmore Lang. Reverend John Dunmore Lang was a Scottishman who came out trying to establish Australia's republic. He hated the British rule at that particular time.
Hmm.
And we have a raft of poets. Daniel Dennehy was one. There's a lesser-known poet, Adelaide Ironside. So we stand in the tradition of old Labor, which I think I can safely say died out around about the mid-1950s.
Yeah.
Gough Whitlam tried to do some things with the likes of Jim Cairns, Rex O'Connor, and a couple of other figures that actually represented that old Labor trend, but he got it smashed by the money power, by the forces that wanted to push globalisation and free trade. And in the end, because Gough Whitlam wanted to assert national sovereignty in the tradition of old Labor by what was called buying back the farm, that is nationalising the mines, the mining industry in this country by using overseas money, he actually bucked the banking system, the established British banking system, by going outside the country to a line of credit which was not supported by the British Empire. And consequently, he was sacked by the Queen through her agent, Sir John Kerr.
Right.
Now, the lie of this is, John Kerr did it without the Queen knowing. Well, that's absolute bunk. I mean, this guy really loved to be a decorated hero, so he got so many letters after his name after doing that. It was clear that this was a reward for dumping Whitlam, which he would have been on the phone to Buckingham Palace getting his orders. There's no doubt about that. And you also have to understand that the Queen herself is the largest institutional shareholder of Rio Tinto. So she's had a lot of benefit from by not having our Australian mines nationalised back in Whitlam's time.
Right. So, okay, question, like, where do you sort of position yourself in relation to the kind of dichotomy between socialist, collectivist economic model versus free market libertarianism?
It comes down to the question of entrepreneurship and the development of the physical economy, that there's some things within the physical economy that require a dirigistic approach by government, that is government-directed credit, government-directed development, and that should be in the form of infrastructure, hard and soft. That should never be opened up for free market profiteering like we have today, where you see the privatisation of water, power and electricity and so forth, such that, you know, the myth is that the public sector can't run these things anywhere near as efficiently as the private sector. Well, I've had discussions with many people in road building, Victoria Roads, for example, and other places, and the amount of looting and graft and corruption that goes on with these external contracts, the amount of money Macquarie Bank has ripped out of the system, for example, on toll roads, that's a complete lie. If you have a system of government then that promotes the physical economy, you want to have a manufacturing industry that is profitable, you want to have agricultural production that is profitable, and you want to have access to minerals, technology and energy that is as cheap as possible. And as soon as you start to bring the private enterprise into that, where you've got the profit motive of private corporations and private shareholders, then you immediately have a clash with the idea of developing the common good or the public good for the entirety of your society. So in terms of the that sort of a policy, you create the conditions whereby individual entrepreneurs, people that have got a bit of get up and go in them, can get support to develop their enterprise. So through their creativity, through their enterprise and their hard work, you expand the amount of goods and services provided to the Australian people in real terms. In other words, we have, you know, many, many small manufacturing industries, not just big ones, but small ones as well, that are producing the necessary goods that we need as a society, rather than what we have today, where basically, you know, 70-80% of what we purchase in the store today comes from China, and the quality is nowhere near as what it was when we made our own goods here in this country. And the same goes for food. We've lost nearly 50% of our family farmers under this policy of deregulation, globalisation and free trade. We need to go back to a policy where the government says we will support our family food producers, which means marketing boards that regulate the price so that farmers actually get parity pricing. That is, they get the actual cost, which includes profit, so that their families can live at a decent market standard of living for what they produce and not loot the land by having to produce stuff continuously without fertilising it or replenishing it. And these are the sorts of policies that we stand for. So not government control, not government control or socialism from the point of view of governing individuals' thought processes and telling them how to do things, but creating the circumstances through directed credit to provide the infrastructure where people say, well, I can go and do that, and they have a sense that their government supports their enterprise. But not for the sake of pure profit motives at the expense of society at large. And that's the difference between, say, the American system of political economy, which is what we support, as opposed to the free market British model, which actually is what was most typified by the opium and slave trading of the British East India Company in the 18th and the 19th centuries.
Which was a form of economic sort of control, sort of tyranny, because they controlled all of this. They had all this power and they had this, I guess, fleets and they had all these resources that the big companies like the East India Company owned that could then be used as an arm of policy of the empire. So is it something like a collusion between big business and the government agenda?
Well, today the policy of privatisation and of globalisation is exactly the same policy.
Yes.
There's no difference. There's actually no difference whatsoever, because this time what you have is the control of finance instead of the shipping routes, you've now got the control of finance that determines who gets the funds and who doesn't. And that's what controls world commerce today. Is this what we have sitting over the world's economy or the individual nations' economies of the world is this British monetary system, which has created enormous debt. And we, you know, this British system of, is what's actually prevailing today. Now, when I say British system, I refer to the British Empire. Now, you know, back in the 19th century, they used to use their gunboats in order to enforce their trade, as you're indicating.
Yes.
Today, they don't do that. They actually don't have the gunboats or the redcoats anymore.
Mm.
What they have is the City of London and Wall Street.
Mm.
So, consequently, that's how things are controlled. Now, since the 1970s, right, well, coming out of the war period, particularly the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt took on the City of London and Wall Street by implementing a policy called Glass-Steagall at that point, because the free trade market, the competition and everything in the...
Sorry about that, Craig. Yeah, we're just going to break again. We'll get back into Glass-Steagall and the co-opted system after the next break, and I also want to try and squeeze in some questions about Fabian socialism, eugenics, climate change, and Charles Darwin. I don't know if we're going to get it in.
Okay.
Sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back to the show. Now, I'd like to just continue from where we left off there, Craig. You were referring to the Glass-Steagall Act, which is extremely important, and I'll just let you finish that point that you were making.
Yes, well, if we come back into the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt faced the same problems that we face today. I'd say the problems today are worse, but because we have more ignorant people. But he faced the same problem, that the City of London, Wall Street, had looted the American population, that they'd... basically caused an enormous amount of homelessness from the, you know, speculation in housing and all sorts of things. So he created the Glass-Steagall as a first of a series of financial bills that separated out the commercial banking system, which is the normal banking system you need for an economy, from the investment or merchant banking system, which was basically the ones that were speculating with depositors' funds. Now, they were completely separate. So were insurance houses, so were brokerage houses. They were separated out from the commercial banking system, and the whole thing was tightly regulated. Now, beginning in the 1970s, with the decoupling of the US dollar from gold under Nixon, you had a breakdown of what was called the post-war Bretton Woods system based upon that Glass-Steagall model. And then finally in 1990, I think it was under Bill Clinton, he repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, and at that point you had this wholesale, huge development of what was called derivatives and basically debt speculative instruments that have built up to the point that there's something like $1.4 quadrillion of these things sitting on the world's economy today.
Mm.
So unless we return to a Glass-Steagall standard where we basically write off that unpayable debt and go back to supporting commercial banking that has... you know, and support the debt with commercial banking that has got legitimate claim on the economy and write off the gambling debts like derivatives and so forth, this economy cannot be repaired, cannot be changed.
Sure. And so you are a proponent of government regulation and nationalisation of certain industries. So you're not a person, you're not really quite like Ron Paul, are you?
No. No, we have a different philosophical outlook, I would say, on that. Like I said, we stand in the position of the heritage of our Australian Labor Party, early Labor Party. They didn't have any qualms.
Right.
Certain members of those of actually fighting for the general welfare of the population first and foremost.
Right. But at the same time as that, you're an extremely harsh critic of Fabian socialism, which you see as connected to eugenics, the nanny state, and, of course, climate change policies ultimately leading to or driven by an agenda for population reduction, again with an underlying eugenics agenda. Can you explain how that fits in? I mean, how do we go? How do we explain it? I mean, I'll turn it over to you.
Roll with like it. It sounds like a mouthful, but see, again, with all these, if people try to connect the dots together, it doesn't make sense unless you can come top down from the biggest philosophical and battle in history.
Yeah.
And this is this concept of empire, or what we call the oligarchical principle, where you have this idea that there's an elite that believes it has a role to determine the destiny of human beings. And they treat human beings like cattle to be traded, sold, killed, culled, whatever. They don't care because they are regarded as, in a sense, like the gods of Olympus.
Yeah.
Now, when the United States was formed, it was formed on a different principle. It was the idea of the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, driven by this concept of that man is actually not an animal, but man is created, what we call imago Dei, in the image of the Creator, living image of the Creator. And that we're endowed with creative reason. We can make discoveries of universal physical principles. And if that is that process, that creativity is fostered, and we, through an education process, learn more and more about how the universe works through discovering these physical principles, through the application of those into technology, we just literally transform the environment such that we can support more and more people at a higher and higher standard of living.
Right.
This was actually done by Abraham Lincoln. When he defeated the British-backed Confederacy in the 1860s, he embarked upon the building of the Transcontinental Railroad system, which saw a massive increase in optimism because this was a chance for America to become what it actually was destined to be. In response to that, the British actually freaked out. I'm talking about the British Empire here, and particularly, you know, Edward VII and others freaked out. So they supported a bunch of people. Those in particular were people like Thomas Huxley, Bertrand Russell, H.G. Wells, of which H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, and Julian Huxley, that's Thomas Huxley's grandson, founded the Fabian Society directly as an instrument to destroy the cultural optimism that came from the process of the American Revolution, followed up by Lincoln's tremendous optimism that he unleashed. Now, the Fabian Society's main supporter, you might say, was a guy by the name of Thomas Malthus. Parson Thomas Malthus was not just any old person. He wasn't just a parson, but he was actually the official chief economist for the British East India Company, right, which was the largest monopoly the world had ever seen in the 18th and 19th century, and was actually part of the British Empire. Malthus was the guru for Charles Darwin. He was also the guru for Thomas Huxley. He was the guru for all this population control doctrines that have come ever since. And that's when we wrote our paper on the humbuggery of Charles Darwin. What people get confused about or don't even know is that Charles Darwin attributed everything that he actually discovered and thought to Thomas Malthus.
Right.
And ironically, Thomas Malthus wasn't just Thomas Malthus. He actually plagiarized from himself, from a Venetian priest by the name of Gian Maria Ortez.
Okay.
Ortez himself had written a book attacking the American founding father Benjamin Franklin's beautiful 1751 pamphlet called Observations Concerning the Increase of Mankind, in which Franklin had foreseen and welcomed the doubling of the American population every 25 years. So
right.
This issue, when we talk about environmentalism, when we talk about Darwinism, and you go back and you look at the Fabian Society, it's all driven by this issue of overpopulation. So the fact that the services today, in dramatic ways, with Prince Philip coming out and saying that if he if he ever comes back, he'd like to be, after he dies, he'd like to be reincarnated as a deadly virus.
Yes, a quote from Prince Philip. It's definitely
that
real.
A quote from Prince Philip. I mean, because this is actually how these guys think. They see that mankind, the increase in mankind's population is a blight upon the earth. At the same time as they do that, they restrict, of course, the development of science and technology that we can't actually solve, aren't allowed to solve, not we can't solve, but aren't allowed to solve the development of the technologies and the scope of the technologies in order to feed and to clothe and to properly house the populations. Mm-hmm. Our planet is actually empty when you look at the surface area, when you look at what's being used and utilized and so forth. It's completely underdeveloped in terms of water resources, and a lot of places is plain empty. So what we've been brainwashed with in the last 100 to 200 years, but also specifically since the formation by Prince Philip, Prince Bernard, and Julian Huxley of the World Wildlife Fund back in the 1947 period after the World War II, is that we've seen more and more of an operation to push this idea that population growth is a detrimental thing.
Sure, and of course, population was and is, a key part of environmental movements. And of course, the Club of Rome, Limits to Growth, that was the essential message of that, which then carried through into the later Kyoto conference. And the key thing here that links it all together with climate change is that carbon dioxide, which of course is a gas that's emitted by all living beings, including you and me, is now seen as a deadly pollutant. And of course, well, what's the best way to get rid of a deadly pollutant? Get rid of whoever's producing it, which ultimately means people.
Yes, and that's the intention.
Yeah, and I think it's just like for listeners to really understand this is that when you demonize carbon dioxide, you are demonizing living things. You are demonizing people. And what you're saying is that this whole thing has its roots in Fabian socialism and the ideas of Thomas Malthus, which go back 150 years, which really were the precursors to the ideas that became environmentalism. But then,
They directly were. It was a case that Prince Philip, Prince Bernard of the Netherlands, who was a self-confessed Nazi, and Julian Huxley literally set up the World Wildlife Fund in order to push environmentalism as another word for eugenics. And eugenics is basically the art of making sure that you separate out those fit to survive and those who are not fit to survive, and the people who are the determine who is fit to survive are these oligarchs and elite. And they basically say British white-skinned people are the people who should survive, and every dark people, whether they be tan, yellow or black, should be allowed to perish.
Indeed.
That's actually what they say. So.
Right, right.
And it's pretty horrendous stuff. But, Herbert, I mean, I know your listeners will be saying, wow, that's a lot of stuff to take in.
Yeah.
That's the New Citizen that you've had a chance to read. I'm happy to offer that to anyone that wants to have a look at our material in depth.
Great.
And that's available if they want to call our free call number on 1-800-636-432.
Sure.
Or go to our website, www.cecaust.com.au. I don't want people to believe me and take what I'm saying off face value. We've produced a paper here. It's 52 pages. It goes through this entire material. It gives the relevant documentation in terms of citations necessary in the text for people to follow it up for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's really what, I mean, the whole program that you're promoting, of course, your program is about people finding out the truth. And, I really do recommend that people get a copy of our paper and then take it from there.
Yeah, it is absolutely crucial that people do the research. I mean, listening to a show like this is great to stimulate you, but I would never encourage anyone to just repeat what they hear on a show. Like, it's easy to do that, and I find myself occasionally doing that, but the point is we're just here to provide a branching point. Now, we're just about at the end. Look, thanks. I'd like to do a whole show on some of these questions about eugenics and also looking at the theory of evolution. I'm going away for a while over December, but I'd really like to have you on. Maybe we can do a series of shows. I'd really like to get into some of this in depth.
Well, you're most welcome to do it any time, Howard, after in the new year.
Great.
We've only just touched on one of many, many topics that the CEC has done in
We're going to have to wind it up now. Sorry, Craig.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.